And welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast on Net-Centric Warfare, how cost internet communications, data handling, and protocols enable tomorrow's digital battlefield. Today's speakers are from Advanced I.O. Systems, Curtiss-Wright Controls Embedded Computing, Mercury Computer Systems, and Tech Microsystems. I'm Chris Schufo, Group Editorial Director for OSM's Military and Aerospace Group of Publications and Websites. Of pertinence to today's eCast are our magazines VME and Critical Systems, Military Embedded Systems, and our all-digital publication, DSP-FPGA.com. The fourth wave of the Internet is upon us, with millions of new users joining the interweb every year, and tens of millions of connected devices are sharing everything from simple keywords to location-aware mashup concert databases. Web 2.0 applications like Twitter, combined with an always-on BlackBerry or iPhone, have taken the world by storm. Today, everyone demands network connectivity, and so does our military. These same civilian COTS technologies are bringing about nothing short of a revolution on the digitized battlefield as the time from sensor to shooter shortens due to faster pipes, smart sensors, massive data storage, and streamlined protocols. Specifically today's eCast, Rob Kraft from Advanced I.O. Systems will discuss 10 gigabit Ethernet in net-centric warfare, why commercial network cards can't drive your application. Naman Arshad and Mike McPherson from Curtiss-Wright Controls Embedded Computing will present Transformational Intra-Platform Networks. Sarah Leeper from Mercury Computer Systems will discuss Converged Sensor Networking Addresses Net-Centric Warfare. And finally, Andy Reddick from Tech Microsystems will finish up today's eCast by presenting Network-Centric FPGA-Based Computing. I'll introduce each speaker and give you their biography before they begin. Now some housekeeping items. Today's total briefing will consume about 50 minutes, leaving us 10 minutes or so for questions at the very end. Please be sure to have all pop-up blockers disabled or at least allow pop-ups from ON24. You'll also find on your console window a button that allows you to enter questions in real time. We'll do our best to address them during the closing Q&A session. If you have a question intended for a specific speaker, please so note at the beginning of your question. Else, I'll parcel the questions equally amongst our speakers. And if you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, one of our technicians will respond back to you privately. And note that as much as we'd like to, we may not get to all of your questions today. In that case, someone may get back to you after the eCast with more information. Our sponsors have also asked us to insert several very brief poll questions during the eCast. If one of these pops up on your screen, we ask that you take 30 seconds or less to check the boxes and answer the questions. There's also a very brief closing survey at the end. And oh yes, before I forget, the eCast will be posted online within 48 hours, and an audio podcast will also be available. More details later. So are we ready? Rob Kraft is VP of Marketing at Advanced I.O. Systems. He has more than 13 years of experience in systems engineering, FAE, and business roles in the embedded real-time space. Prior to joining Advanced I.O. Systems, he worked at Spectrum Signal Processing in Allied Signal Aerospace. Rob has a Master's of Applied Science in Electrical Engineering from the University of Toronto. Rob, you're up.
Thank you, Chris. Let me get right into it. The newest James Bond film comes out this Friday. That's November 14th for the benefit of those who are watching this archived. And I'm predicting that this time, when the gadget guy Q is equipping Bond with all the latest techno gizmos, that he'll be handing him gadgets emblazoned with logos like BlackBerry and thumb-sized devices with a logo of a bitten apple that he'll boast can record over 35 hours of CD-quality sound, James. And then he'll send Bond for virtual training missions on their new realistic simulated training environment, acronymed the RSTE, and consisting of the PlayStation 3 and the Wii. The world has flipped 180 degrees. No longer is the coolest technology developed for the military and then later commercialized. Now the Defense Department is playing catch-up to the COTS world. As Chris said in the opening, ordinary people today are accustomed to a profoundly high level of networking connectivity, enabled largely by Ethernet and Internet protocol, and the military wants the same. The appeal of using Ethernet-based networking in a digitized battlefield is, I think, clear. And now, the advent of 10 gigabit Ethernet means that Ethernet is no longer limited to the command and control fabric in systems, but can also function as the fat pipe that reaches all the way to the high bandwidth sensors. So it's probably not surprising that 10 gig E is being designed into more and more defense applications, both in the main network and as the pipe to and from sensors and effectors. But the use of 10 gig E as a real-time data plane fabric in military applications is not without some problems that need to be solved. At a high level, it's the problem of trying to drink from a fire hose. Now, I don't know if you've ever tried drinking from a fire hose, well, since college, but this guy's obviously not having much success. He's not only unable to digest or process the water, he can't even ingest it. A processor faced with a 10 gig E pipe has pretty much the same problem. To put it more quantitatively, there's an, albeit conservative, rule of thumb that it takes about 1 gigahertz of CPU processing per gigabit of Ethernet traffic. This means that CPUs will be completely consumed trying to run Ethernet protocol at 10 gigabits per second and will still fall well short of the bandwidth. Of course, this problem is not unique to 10 gig E in NetCentric defense application. It applies equally well to commercial world servers, and there are already a variety of solutions used there. So why not just adopt these commercial solutions into defense? Well, even putting aside the typical form factor, environmental packaging, and lifecycle management issues, I contend that the problem faced by defense applications are sufficiently different from those in the commercial space that this simple approach won't meet requirements. Now let's look at these problems a bit. The first problem is that high-performance real-time sensor applications, such as radar, often blast large chunks of data, tens to hundreds of thousands of bytes at a time, possibly followed by a longer rest period. Because Ethernet traffic travels in packets, each with the maximum size of 1,500 bytes, or 9,000 bytes in the case of jumbo frames, the receiving end must absorb many back-to-back packets at line rate. Now, if the receiving interface can't absorb all this data, because it can't shovel it into system memory in time, data will be dropped. In a commercial server environment, dropped packets can be resent by the source, but in sensor applications, where there's simply no time or no hardware facility for sensors to resend the data, there is an unacceptable loss of data. Note, this problem is not a result of very high sustained throughput. This is a transient effect and occurs even at arbitrarily low sustained rates. Even if the extended burst occurs only once a day, data would still be lost during that burst. Typical commercial 10G interface cards, designed and cost-optimized for an environment where retransmission of data is permitted and where the extended duration line rate bursts are rare, simply don't have the capability to address the problem. Net-centric applications often involve collecting data from a variety of sensors to synthesize multidimensional models of the environment. In real-time applications such as comment or ELINT direction finding, network surveillance and intercept, and applications relying on the fusion of a variety of sensor data, accurate and precise timestamping of the individual data streams is essential. Conversely, for electronic countermeasures or hardware-in-the-loop simulation systems, the release of data to actuators must be precisely time-gated or synchronized to other events. Precise time-stamping and gating can only be performed through a deterministic interface. It cannot happen at the CPU level, where it's subject to variable software interrupt latencies and varying times to access buses. Commercial applications aim to get traffic from place to place. Time-stamping is not a requirement or facility of typical commercial 10 gig E interface products. This slide shows two different applications that experience the same kind of problem. The diagram on the left represents a multi-camera situational awareness system that employs the industrial standard protocol known as GigE Vision to interface to gigabit Ethernet digital video cameras. GigE Vision runs on top of the standard UDP protocol. The diagram on the right represents an intrusion protection system used to guard a network from viruses, trojans, and other cyber threats coming from the wide area network. The detection of such threats requires the inspection of the content of the data packets, a computationally intensive task at 1 gigabit per second, let alone at 10. Although entirely different applications, they both execute on data arriving at a 10 gigabit per second rate. So even the act of offloading the 10 gig e-transport protocol, which could be provided by a commercial network interface card, is not enough to help the CPU keep up with the application. This is a more subtle problem related to net-centric sensor application, which involve real-time digitized signals as opposed to commercial applications where the data is typically of a digital origin. As real-time digitized signals, they are destined for signal processing. And among other functions, low-pass and band-pass filtering and error correction algorithms are a common part of signal processing and digital communication systems. These algorithms can correct or compensate for occasional or small runs of errors, such as the error in a few consecutive data points. But the algorithms break down when faced with a large run of consecutive errors, as shown in the example here, where a large group of samples is simply missing. The reason this is particularly relevant is that Ethernet data is packetized, and there are checksums and CRC fields at different layers of the IP protocol stack used to check for errors in the packets. When the protocol stack detects an error, it discards the entire packet rather than passing it to the upper layer. So, a checksum error resulting from a small error in just one or two bytes can cause an entire 9,000-byte packet to be dropped, subsequently choking the signal processing algorithm. Now, if this small error had been simply passed to the signal processing application layer, it could have been corrected there. I hope you agree that these aren't four fringe problems, but are legitimate concerns for real-time applications in the digital battlefield. You can get around these problems with an intelligent 10 gigabit Ethernet interface specifically designed to solve them, and FPGAs are a good choice for the engine. FPGAs are capable of the line rate performance needed and have the flexibility to run optimized algorithms to address the variety of unique application requirements that are ignored by the mainstream commercial ASIC-based implementations. Keep the software interface standard, but tailor the implementation via the FPGA. So, to accommodate the extended duration line rate bursts from sensors, you include sufficient memory to act as an input shock absorber. You include a timestamp and synchronization interface in the FPGA to deterministically and precisely stamp the packets as they come off the wire. As well, use that same interface in conjunction with the memory to stage packets and precisely gate their release onto the wire for simulation training or countermeasure applications. And perhaps most critically, implement algorithms that exploit characteristics of the data or of the application to optimize the connectivity as required. And this can take a variety of forms. In some cases, it consists of only transport layer protocol offload, but architected with the application, bus interface, and processor in mind. In cases where the application processing is still a bottleneck at 10 gigabits per second, such as when using the Gigi Vision protocol for video, you can offload that layer, as well as other intensive image processing operations. In the case of packet inspection for intrusion protection, you can alleviate the burden on the CPU by having the 10 gig interface inspect and drop packets that are deemed uninteresting before they ever get to the CPU. And in some cases, the solution involves modifying the transport protocol to tag, but not drop, packets with checksum errors, and to pass them along to the signal processing algorithm intact. Now, I've discussed several problems and solutions, and I want to make it clear this was just not a theoretical exercise. On this slide are some products from Advanced I.O. deployed to solve the problem of drinking from a fire hose. They're in standard form factors, as well as upcoming rugged conduction-cooled XMC, the latter following the draft Vita 42.6 spec for running 10 gig over XMC connectors. They're FPGA-based, and we use a variety of our patent-pending technology to optimize their performance in real-time, high-performance systems. We can supply them with our cores and software specifically for UDP protocol offload, direct data streaming, and a variety of other applications. In summary, there is no question. I think. All right. I see there is a poll question there for you. And in summary, there is no question that civilian COTS technologies, from the ubiquitous internet to the gaming console in your living room, are finding their way into the digitized battlefield and changing both our expectations and the nature and capabilities of net-centric warfare. And when it comes to using 10GigE in these high-performance real-time applications, what I've tried to point out here is that it's not enough to simply grab the mass-market technologies off the shelf at the virtual big-box store. The key is to tap into the advantages of 10GigE as a standardized interface while understanding and respecting the unique requirements of net-centric warfare applications and using implementations designed to meet those unique requirements. Well, that's it for me now, so back to you, Chris.
Thanks, Rob. I got a chuckle at your virtual mass market big box store. Thank you. Our next speaker today actually is two speakers. Second company, Curtiss-Wright Controls Embedded Computing. Numan Arshad is Senior Product Line Manager for Curtiss-Wright Controls Embedded Computing's networking, security, and modified COTS product lines. He has over 16 years' experience in the defense and telecommunications industries. Numan has a degree in aerospace engineering with a concentration in electronics and systems from Carleton University in Ontario, Canada. Our other speaker is Mike McPherson, who is currently the Director of Business Development for Curtiss-Wright Controls Embedded Computing Division. Mike has over 25 years' experience in the defense industry. He began his career supporting anti-submarine warfare systems at Lockheed Martin Corporation in Southern California. And in 1985, he helped found Vista Controls Corporation, a pioneer in bringing COTS solutions to the military. In 2000, Mike joined the MITRE Corporation, a federally funded research and development company, as senior technical manager. His most notable assignment there was that of program manager for MITRE support to the Army's Future Combat Systems Program. In this capacity, Mike led the development of the network-centric system of systems architecture for FCS. Long resumes for both of these two gentlemen, but I believe, Mike, you're up first.
Thank you, Chris. And I realized that when I put that together, when I said over 25 years of experience, that makes me feel rather old right now. But let's get started. As the slide discusses, we're here to talk about intra-platform networking and the transformation to an intra-platform network battlefield. And so the initial question is, what is that, and why would we do such a thing? The network-centric warfare is all about the network. Well, actually, the DoD's network-centric warfare concept of operation relies heavily on what they refer to as a robustly networked force. This robustly networked force is enabled through network-ready platforms. These are the driving forces that are coming from the Defense Department to enable the network-centric operations that they feel will give us the technological edge in the battlefield. We're here today to discuss the platform's role in the network enablement within those platforms. The concepts we'd like to introduce are intra-platform networks, which is defined as an IP-based network of computing and storage systems within any given platform. This is the underlying concept that enables the robust network-enabled platforms in the battlefield. In addition, we'd like to introduce the concept of transformational interplatform networks. This is the concept of taking today's platforms that are in the battlefield today and transforming them to the network-centric enabled platforms of tomorrow, and doing that in step as we move from today's current force to tomorrow's modern force. So what is the role of the platform in the battlefield? Well, the platform includes the warfighters, the crew stations, the actual sensors that collect the information, the communication devices, the network attachment equipment, and the actual effectors in the battlefield, whether that be lethal as in the form of guns or non-lethal as in the form of security and stability operation tools. It also provides for the mobility, the survivability, the ability to network those sensors, the fusion of the information management, and the control of those effects. What does this enable in the battlefield? This is where the information superiority comes from. The edge of the battlefield is where that information resides. Collecting that information is provided through the sensors attached to those platforms, bringing that information into the commanders so that they can make their can share awareness of the battlefield, they can self-synchronize, and from that, they're able to provide a command and control capability that exceeds the ability of the enemy. And they're able to synchronize their effects through that network attachment of the sensor to commander to shooter. As mentioned before, in a lot of cases, there's commercial equipment that have driven the commercial environment as far as connecting the mobile office and the enterprise and connecting all of us to our enterprise. But that equipment doesn't quite work in the robust networked battlefield, also known as the tactical internet or the rugged internet. Although they follow the same standards, the environment that this equipment is deployed into is much harsher. It's an austere environment. In a lot of cases, the equipment has to meet the same battlefield requirements of the rad-hard, ruggedized equipment of those platforms. So that brings a different set of challenges in the form of space, weight, power, cooling. These are all challenges that are satisfied in the commercial environment, in environment control that is unavailable in the battlefield. The physical form factors that are being driven in the battlefield are much smaller, much more robust, and require a functional density far beyond that is required in the commercial environment. And from that, we have worked in the standards community to provide the form factors that will enable network-centric communication and network-centric networking equipment to be deployed in the battlefield. I'd like to turn the discussion over to Noman Arshad, who's going to get into the technical enablement and the drivers that are driving the network-centric battlefield and the intra-platform networks. Noman, over to you.
Thanks, Mike. So I'm just kind of very high level, and I want to talk about some of the high-level trends that are driving networking into the deeply embedded systems within platforms. So we're looking at two types of drivers that are forming the transformation of net-centric communications in the battlefield. One is a top-down driver. As you can see on this diagram, you have on the far right a set of networked platforms that need to communicate over a common protocol like IP, for example. And on the left-hand side of this slide, you have what is embedded inside a platform. So the IP scales deeply into the system. So through an IP modem, it can be the IP protocol can be used to connect chassis together for communication purposes. You can have IP cross the backplane to talk to different cards. And there are even applications where you have a multi-CPU card or blade, and the CPUs communicate amongst themselves using IP as well. So IPv4 and v6 appear to be the ubiquitous communication protocol that DoD would like to use for net-centric communication. It is finding its way deep into the embedded platforms, and the transport of the IPv4 or v6 is naturally Ethernet, which can scale from as low as 10 megabits per second up to 10 gigabits per second. Much of this technology is out today, and many of these COTS vendors are building boards that support these types of rates. So that's a top-down driver. Protocols are IP, and the fabric appears to be Ethernet. What about the bottom-up? So if we look at the component level, the system on chips or the processors are now transforming too, where they're becoming more integrated. So you have not just one core, you have multiple cores that are being integrated into CPUs. Then you have high-speed serial interfaces also being integrated into the CPUs. High-speed serial interfaces like Serial Rapid I.O., PCI Express, and 1-in-10 gig Ethernet. And board vendors today, the transformation that's happening is the board vendors are changing their design to include switches or on a board. So, for example, if the fabric in a system-on-chip is S3O or Serial Rapid I.O. or PCI Express, the natural thing is to add a Serial Rapid I.O. or PCI Express switch and then bring that out to the backplane to facilitate a high-speed data plane. So that is the bottom-up trend. But where does the top-down gigabit Ethernet and IP protocol and this S3O and PCI Express high-speed data plane fabrics, how do they fit together? So that can be explained by a very generic diagram, a flow diagram of data. So if you look at the
square box in the dashed line. It is meant to represent a platform. You have sensors that take in raw data that come into a line replaceable unit that may have 1-to-N cards in it that do the processing. You have a very high-speed data plane in the back plane that moves the data back and forth for different levels of processing of the data until it's crunched down. The fabrics that are used typically today for high-speed, low-latency, deterministic movement of data across blades are fabrics like Cirro Rapid I/O, PCI Express, and now 10 gig is now coming into the fold. Once the data is crunched, then there's typically a much smaller amount of information that is actionable intelligence. So it might be like coordinates of a target or other information like that. That can simply be packetized over IP, depending on the application, and sent to other line replaceable units or maybe up to a monitor to display or to a storage area device inside the vehicle or out to an IP modem or radio that can then be transmitted to other platforms for shared situational awareness and fusion of data or back to command and control for decisions. So here's an example of how this all comes together on a in a system. So this is an example of an intra-platform network that has been transformed to facilitate the high-speed data movement across fabrics that are highlighted in red for Cirro Rapid I/O, PCI Express, or 10 gig, and gigabit Ethernet that straps across the bottom in this standard. And this standard is called VITA 46. And it is actually the next generation standard for many military electronics that lend nicely to the net-centric infrastructure. So in this flow of data, you see sensors at the bottom that are connected to these boards that come in through a connector called P5 or P6, and it gets processed on the blades. The data move across the blades using the Cirro Rapid I/O backplane fabric, and then once they're packetized, they can be sent over gigabit Ethernet to a centralized switch or router, a 1 or 10 gigabit Ethernet switch or router, that then passes through some security chipset that can then send the data out of the line replaceable module. So to help explain a bit further that net-centric infrastructure, Curtis Wright's products here is one line of products, which is the switches and routers, which really form the infrastructure for the net-centric communications needed for network communications. And one product I'd like to point out, which is probably the world's smallest, densest, ruggedest router out there today, which is the VPX3-683, which has 24 ports of gigabit Ethernet and 2 ports of 10 gigabit Ethernet. And it's developed in accordance to VITA 46 and VITA 48 standards. It supports two-level maintenance, which can save quite a bit of cost in the field. And with that, I'm going to pass it back to Mike to wrap up.
Thank you, Naman. So in summary, I guess there's some points we'd like you to walk away with. The concept of network-centric warfare and the robustly networked force that is desired through that network-centric warfare requires a network everywhere. And in the battlefield, the network comes with the platforms. The rugged internet is a bring-your-own-bandwidth. It's part of the systems that are being deployed. There's not a fixed infrastructure to provide that capability. The military platforms are the network kiosks for the global information grid and the commanders in the battlefield. Secure, rugged, embedded COT solutions for interplatform networks are the enabling technology for the network-ready platforms. Backplane protocols and connectivity required standardization, and that's the key to the success of being able to provide the interoperability required in a network-centric environment. The concept of transformational interplatform networks bring the network to the battlefield, enabling the network-centric warfare. Thank you very much. Back to you, Chris.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Naman. Hey, bring your own bandwidth. That's a good one. We're going to put that on buttons at the next conference. Our third speaker today is Sarah Leeper, who has worked for Mercury Computer Systems for the past 4 years in product development and business development roles. She is responsible for defining next-generation products. Prior to Mercury, Sarah was employed at MIT Lincoln Laboratory as a systems engineer specializing in reconfigurable processing systems.
Sarah is in the process of completing her MBA from Southern New Hampshire University and holds a BS in Computer Engineering and Neuroscience from the University of Pittsburgh. Over to you, Sarah.
Thanks, Chris. So just before we get started, I just want to give you a brief introduction to Mercury Computer Systems. Mercury has been solving challenging problems in high-performance embedded computing for the last 27 years. We're based out of Chelmsford, Massachusetts, with 645 employees worldwide. Our largest business unit is Advanced Computing Systems, ACS, which focuses on both defense and commercial markets. The defense segment includes radar, electronic warfare, sonar, electro-optical, and C4I, while our commercial segments address medical, homeland security, semiconductor, EDA, and telecommunications. So all of us have been talking about network-centric warfare, and basically today's generation of soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines expect connectivity from the battlefield, as do their officers right up the chain of command. Despite such demands, there have been several challenges that stand in the way of getting information to the warfighter in a timely and accurate manner. As this need for information continues to increase, the inability of today's data dissemination architecture to keep up with the needs of the soldier become more apparent. For ISR in particular, that misalignment is made evident by Secretary Gates' public frustration with the fact that ground-based exploitation takes too much time, too much bandwidth, and too many analysts. The solution of putting more platforms in theater runs the risk of exasperating an already unbalanced architecture. What takes so much time, bandwidth, and analysis is the simple fact that it takes multiple looks by multiple sensors to accurately survey a potential target, and the process of exploiting and fusing those multiple looks for accuracy is done manually today. As a result, we need to transition to an ISR architecture that offloads the analysts from some of their exploitation and fusion responsibilities, with the goal of reducing the amount of time it takes to get accurate information to the tactical user. So Mercury is addressing this need for transition with what we're calling the Converged Sensor Network Architecture. Basically, it's a revolutionary open architecture that combines sensor signal processing with information management technologies to deliver transformational access to information in the tactical edge. By bringing data exploitation on board this architecture and networking that function to multiple sensors and their signal processing assets, the end user somewhere in the network cloud can tune the knowledge extraction process to their specific needs. By consolidating those capabilities in a single unified architecture, the convergence of multiple sensors, multiple missions, and multiple users is made possible, thus providing the warfighter with timely, actionable information. So I guess there's a little poll question right here, if you don't mind answering. So although CSN is applicable to the C4ISR market, it's important to note that the core technology comes from Mercury's work with its commercial customers. Advances in commercial communications and networking using our ATCA platform for 3G base stations, as well as exploitation using the cell processor, have led to developments in network convergence, information management, and application acceleration, which form the building blocks for CSN. It is the combination of these technologies when applied to the digital battlefield that will enable sensor on demand at the tactical edge and remove the stovepipe architectures with limited connectivity. So basically, to peel back the onion a little more on CSN, the architecture introduces four transformational capabilities: virtual sensors, service-oriented architecture, open architecture, and high availability. By onloading exploitation and sensor fusion and presenting those capabilities as a network-based service to the user, CSN enables the concept of virtual sensor to be introduced. Basically, a virtual sensor, it's a network of sensors shared by many virtual missions, each configured and deployed using a real-time service-oriented architecture. As exploitation is as much of an art as it is a science, it starts in the lab being trained on mission-specific forensic data, and it's never perfect, so it may have to go back to the lab multiple times. A truly open, plug-and-play architecture that spans development time, deployment constraints, and complex mission environment would be a great advantage for today's warfighter. CSN is intended to enable some of these capabilities in the field today. Knowledge extraction would be hundreds of times more valuable than the current data dissemination network that we have today. So high availability is absolutely necessary in keeping the system working while maintaining the required quality of service to our warfighters. So basically, SigmaNet, which you see on this slide, is Mercury's first converged sensor network solution. SigmaNet solution enables converged sensor networking architecture on an embedded multi-computer platform by bridging the network protocols of the platform backbone into the heart of the embedded system without sacrificing the high performance required for that embedded signal processor. To the resources who need it, the embedded system looks and acts just like a standard IP-based cluster, allowing the translation of cluster-based algorithms in a conditioned lab space to new, rugged, embedded platforms to aid the warfighter in the field. The ability to achieve real-time performance is not sacrificed for the sake of network capabilities, nor is the embedded system segmented away from the platform backbone. Failover capabilities are also provided to allow for continued operation even under equipment fault. As hardware and software, SigmaNet components are based on open standards, and they eliminate the need for proprietary interfaces. By bridging 10 gigabit Ethernet to the high-speed Zero Rapid I.O. fabric and by implementing all the features inherent to standard IP operations, SigmaNet allows the signal processor to perform routing, multicast and broadcast, and security operations. So this slide just shows an example configuration that has been delivered already to a Mercury customer. Dual gateway modules provide interfaces to 10 gigabit Ethernet sensor networking backbone. Employing the Ethernet over Rapid I.O. protocol, the gateway is used to stream data from the external network into the Rapid I.O. inter-chassis network, where data processing takes place on several VXS200 single board computers. The VXS200 dual 7448 SBCs are integrated to do the high-speed data computation. The SBCs, each with two independent processing nodes, are programmed to work together as a tightly coupled compute cluster using Rapid I.O. Each VXS200 is programmed via software to allow failover of another VXS200. And dual Rapid I.O. switch modules are added to the system to enable failover capability. The two serial Rapid I.O. VXS switch modules, each with six 8-port serial Rapid I.O. crossbar ASICs and a two-level hierarchy, are included in the system to facilitate the low latency, deterministic Rapid I.O. communications. Software is available allowing all data movement operations to migrate to the redundant switch module upon failure of the first. The Ethernet over Rapid I.O. protocol gives the system designers the flexibility to mix and match the use of Ethernet where it makes sense while taking full advantage of the robust Rapid I.O. fabric to perform the rigorous high-speed signal processing. Rapid I.O. encapsulation was employed to stream all types of data through the Mercury embedded computing system, while 10 gigabit Ethernet was the conduit that enabled the distribution of consoles appearing in the application software as IP nodes to see the resulting images. So lastly, over the last few years, Mercury has amassed the right capabilities to enable a net-centric solution for our customers. CSN stitches together in a single architecture the important building blocks of the future of ISR. The future of ISR starts with the sensor. No amount of computing can make up for not taking advantage of the full fidelity of the sensor. Acquire, digitize, and process is about preserving, enhancing the fidelity of our customer sensors. Our Ecotec product line, delivering world-class integrated performance with a modular architecture, and PowerStream product line, delivering world-class processing density as close to the sensor as possible, form the backbone of this side of CSN. In addition, we fully integrated our telecommunications and defense product lines into a coherent architecture for exploitation and dissemination to directly address the warfighter's concern, access to timely and accurate information. So thank you very much. If you have any more, would like to hear any more information on CSN or anything about the products I talked about today, please visit csn.mc.com. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks very much, Sarah. Our fourth and final speaker today is Andrew Rettig, who is president, CTO, and co-founder of Tech Microsystems. Tech Microsystems was founded in 1981 as an engineering services organization while Andy was a student at MIT. Today, Tech Microsystems is a leading supplier of advanced streaming I.O. products and provides embedded VME solutions employing a combination of onboard fabric, FPGA, and PowerPC technology.
Andy, it's been worth the wait. You're up next. Go ahead.
Thanks very much, Chris. And I even remembered to push my mute button on, so there it is. Let's see. My colleagues have done a really good job of explaining why net-centric technology is interesting to the defense market. I'm actually going to drill down a little bit more precisely to some of the technology that we work with specifically that enables network-centric architectures. So the line I'm going to draw here is I'm going to start with a traditional signal processing system, sort of your traditional VXS or VME processing system, a lot of processors, some kind of switch fabric. And there are two trends that we see that are happening to these systems today. One is the trend to FPGA-centric architectures, because it's pretty much a given these days. Everybody knows that FPGAs give you size, weight, and power advantages over power PCs or x86. And the second trend, which is really the focus of all of our talks today, is the orientation towards network architectures as opposed to more embedded-centric architectures. So since we do a lot of work with FPGAs, the big question for us and the problem statement for today is how do you network enable systems that have lots of FPGAs in them? So to start with, we've got a sort of traditional high-performance signal processor here. The diagram on the right, we've got sensor I.O. coming in to the I.O. processors feeding a fabric. Hanging off the fabric is a sea of general-purpose computers. Might be dozens, might be as many as 100. Generally running some kind of proprietary real-time operating system with some kind of switched fabric. Switched fabric in the older days might be Raceway or Star Fabric. Today it might be RapidIO. And the sensor interfaces, in our experience, are either analog-type things, because that's what we do, and a lot of what we also do is serial FPDP, but the sensor interface is really just any kind of streaming I.O. Drinking from a fire hose, as Rob indicated. But most of the technology in the system is fairly embedded-centric. I mean, it's using technology that was developed for the embedded marketplace with an embedded focus. Now, the first trend I talked about is evolving to FPGAs. And so I guess I want to be careful to say that this isn't representative of all systems, but these are the systems, the sort of niche of the market that we tend to work with. Is the class of problem where most or all of the general-purpose computers have been replaced with FPGAs. So essentially, we've gone from a large number of GPPs to a smaller number of FPGAs. The I.O. now feeds directly into an FPGA without an intervening fabric, so the I.O. is very tightly coupled to the FPGA. And then we have an interconnect, which tends to be heterogeneous. It's FPGA to FPGA links for high-speed data, and some kind of network or other type of link for control and status traffic. In our applications, we tend to not use general-purpose switch fabrics because we're very focused on FPGA performance, and therefore the overhead of the endpoint for a switch fabric is unattractive. So for this class of problem, the general-purpose computing problem has collapsed down to one or two processors, which then means that you can tend to leverage Intel Linux-type ecosystems as opposed to PowerPC / VxWorks, et cetera-type ecosystems, because your number of GPPs has gotten smaller. So what do we do to network-enable the FPGAs? We developed a piece of technology that's worked fairly well. That's a combination of software and hardware that bridges the gap between the user software running in a host trying to control an FPGA and the user firmware that's running in the FPGA to actually do the signal processing. So this consists of two separate components. The component on the left is the software stack, where the user software is calling an API, which calls a library, which then calls the underlying socket and network infrastructure, communicates over the network using standard UDP gigabit Ethernet to a piece of firmware that sits in the FPGA that does the UDP processing, the gigabit Ethernet processing, and then the protocol processing. So the net effect is that you have a bridge where you can do different types of semantics directly from user software to user firmware using either remote DMA-type protocols for register access or memory access to set coefficients or program the FPGA in some way, or streaming protocols for data transfers, which could be either potentially low-rate data in or data results, more typically data results coming out. But the point of all this is that the FPGA is all by itself, without a processor sitting next to it, it's a completely network-enabled resource. So the FPGA itself now has a network-enabled endpoint, and it enables the system to scale very easily so that one host can manage large numbers of FPGAs. It also decouples the host from the backplane. Since the host talks over a network, it no longer needs to be an SBC in the backplane. It could be something sitting someplace else controlling the system. And because the interface is firmware-based, it's very easy to support wire-speed data links without needing a processor near the FPGA because the processor is doing all the protocol stack. And I just hit page down, which isn't going to work, is it? And so by taking that technology and integrating it with the FPGA-centric system we described before, we've now created a network-centric FPGA control system where each FPGA has a gigabit Ethernet node. This is a VXS-based system, so we're using some VXS standards here, to talk to the single-board computer over gigabit Ethernet. That's VITA 41.3, which is a well-defined ecosystem of resources available to use that. For FPGA communication over the backplane, today we use multiplexed Aurora and gigabit Ethernet links, so you wind up with high-speed data pipes going through Aurora, and you intermix the gigabit Ethernet traffic with those links. A new standard that's come out of VITA is 41.6, which implements a gigabit Ethernet-based control plane, and as the ecosystem develops for that, then you'll be able to avoid those muxed fabric links and just have gigabit Ethernet throughout the system. And so this creates a network-enabled FPGA-based system, but it's still using gigabit Ethernet, not 10 gigabit Ethernet. So I just wanted to, before we dive into 10 gig, just take a moment to recap what's the point of all this. Well, network-centric FPGAs, it creates a very unified, homogeneous interconnect between all the different nodes in the system. I mean, everybody's basically a participant on a network. It allows systems to scale both inside and outside the box without changing the software. The host software that the user is running doesn't particularly care whether the FPGA is in the same box or across the street or on a plane 3,000 miles away. It's all just a network device. This is sort of a key thing for a lot of our users. It eliminates proprietary software APIs. I mean, all of the system interconnect is standard network-type software. So the APIs are very straightforward, and they can migrate from technology to technology without having to change your system software. It also allows users to prototype a system using normal rack and stack technology and then migrate to embedded form factors without having to change their software or their firmware, which is obviously beneficial. We also have seen applications where it's desirable to have the same type of technology deployed in two different versions, a rugged version and maybe a ground station version, and this enables that. But then I think the key thing is that focusing on network-centric technology lets embedded make better use of some of the high-performance technologies that people spend a lot of time and effort creating in the Intel and Linux clustering world. And so things like RDMA protocols and very high-performance 10-gig endpoints and switches, all of those things become available as the larger community develops them, and then you can leverage them. Not every place. As Rob says, there are places where that's not appropriate, but it's still just a much larger ecosystem that we all get to take advantage of. So the bottom line is that network-centric FPGAs create a lot of advantages. The only downside today, looking at systems you can deploy right this minute, is that 10 gigabit Ethernet as a pure fabric isn't yet available. But it's becoming available, and so one of the standards we're very excited about is a new VITA standard in VITA called 41.8, which puts 10 gigabit Ethernet on the fabric. And so at this point, we're taking the same basic system, except instead of Aurora point-to-point links, we go to 10 gigabit Ethernet as a native fabric, 10 gigabit Ethernet inside the box and outside the box. Another advantage this allows is that as sensors get upgraded to use network technologies, your sensor I.O. can start being 10 gigabit Ethernet. And so you get this, to borrow Mercury's phrase, you get this convergence of network technologies and embedded technologies. But what I think is most sort of exciting about it is that you wind up with much more leverage of non-embedded centric software, firmware, and interconnect. And so at the end of the day, you get to ride the curve that has, you know, lots of volume and lots of ecosystem behind it. And every node is just naturally connected. I mean, the end result is that this system is very easy to network enable as part of a larger network-centric battlefield because every single node on it is talking IP as its means of communication just at the core. And so that's what I have for today. So that's what we're doing at Tech Micro.
Thank you very much, Andy. Thank you very much, Andy. And a special thank you to all of our speakers today and their companies. We've got some time for the Q&A, and I noticed there are a number of questions already queued up. So if you do have any questions, I encourage you to type them in, but I will go ahead and get started then. So our first question goes to Rob Kraft of Advanced IO. Where did it go here? You said that the appeal of using Ethernet as the networking technology in the digital battlefield is clear. Can you explain a bit more about why that's the case?
And I think I've now come live again, yes? Okay, so yes, I can. In fact, I think Andy touched on it in some of his comments. I mean, inherently, it facilitates two-way packet-based communication. So, I mean, suddenly now, especially when you're taking it to sensors, you can do health inquiries to various devices. You can reconfigure data flow among different nodes so that the same system device can perform multiple functions. I mean, because now you have packets switched around. And that's just networking in general. But the use of Ethernet and IP makes the software development easier, makes available a greater pool of developers, makes it much easier to port the software as hardware platforms are upgraded. And as we kind of said, virtually everyone already uses it or has some level of comfort with it from their commercial and home lives. So it's really getting on the bandwagon, joining that huge Ethernet juggernaut, which opens up tons of not only equipment and architecture advantages, but also, as I say, resources and developers and things like that, so people who are already familiar with all that socket programming architecture, et cetera. So,
okay. All right. Thank you, Rob. I'm going to follow that up with a similar question aimed at Mercury. What are the benefits, Sarah, of combining 10 gig E with serial rapid I.O.?
Thanks, Chris. Well, basically, what the combination of 10 gig E and serial rapid I.O. give to you is it gives you that interoperability that 10 gigabit Ethernet provides, and in a transparent manner also gives you the high-speed DMA and middleware options of using Sierra Rapid IO within your system, so you don't sacrifice any performance by getting interoperability.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Curtis Wright, either of you two gentlemen, whoever would ever care to join in, can you provide any examples of where your products are being used to enable net-centric warfare in, quote, intra-platform networks, unquote, it says here?
Sure, Chris. This is Mike. I guess the best example is the Army's Future Combat System. Central to the Future Combat System's system of system architecture is what is referred to as the FCS network. This is an architectural concept, and it's critical to the overall system of system capabilities, network-centric capabilities provided by the Future Combat Systems. Central to that implementation is what's called the Integrated Computer System, which is resident in all of the Future Combat System platforms. Curtis Wright provides what's called the General Processor Module and the Gigabit Ethernet Switch Module, which are the core processing and networking functions for those critical Future Combat System systems.
Okay. Thank you very much. Question for Andy at Tech Micro. How much overhead does a network interface add to an FPGA?
Thanks, Chris. That's a good question. The IP core that we described in that diagram runs between maybe 3 to 5% of the FPGA, depending on which features are actually used. But it does actually get back to kind of the ecosystem question. The neat thing about that is that you can leverage the hard IP that's inside an FPGA, like a Xilinx Vertex 5, which has a gigabit Ethernet endpoint. And so unlike a more generic fabric interface, a network interface will tend to be pretty low footprint because the FPGA guys are highly motivated to include the IP in the device.
Okay. Rob, did you want to add any follow-up on that? It wasn't aimed at you, but you may have a perspective on that briefly.
Yeah, I mean, It really does depend how much you're doing. There are simple interfaces where you're just grabbing packets and not doing any protocol offload, and then it really matters how much of the protocol stack or other things that you need to put on top of that in terms of application, if it's an offload case, you need to do in order to really make things work within the FPGA or to wherever it's going after the FPGA.
I think
that percentage can vary greatly from, things that Andy was talking about there to much greater, but still leaving plenty of room for other activities.
All right. Thank you, Rob. Question from Mercury. Are any customers currently using CSN or a SigmaNet solution?
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, actually we have a number of customers using SigmaNet solutions and that are getting ready to deploy today. Probably our most interesting customer case is where basically a naval application where they needed the ability throughout the ship to access information from not only the periscope, but also from the sonar, as well as the ESM systems on board. So we actually worked with them with the Ethernet over Serial Rapid IO technology, converged their systems into one, and gave them that networked access across their platform.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Question for Curtis Wright. This one's a long one, so bear with me as I read it, whoever wrote this one. Often when referring to network-centric warfare, we hear a lot about the, quote, network, as a separate system on the battlefield. I notice that your presentation focuses on the platform. Why is the platform so important in network-centric warfare? Naman or Mike?
Yeah, Chris, this is Mike again. Well, I guess the main difference is, unlike fixed infrastructure-based networks, where there's a set of equipment that's truly dedicated to providing that network infrastructure, the battlefield doesn't really have a fixed infrastructure. It's as I mentioned in my slides, it's a bring-your-own-bandwidth environment. And so the tactical battlefield is a self-forming network. So when you're deployed, there's no network there in most cases. You bring that network with you. So if you look at it in a tactical client-server relationship or a publish and subscribe type network, which are kind of the architectures and the interface protocols in a network-centric environment, the client could be a company commander resident in one platform, let's say a strike or command variant, while the server could be actually a battlefield application server resident in a whole other platform. Example of that is the Army's Airborne Command and Control System. So you see it's the network and the platforms really form that network-centric battlefield together.
Okay, very good. Well, I'm watching the clock here to all of our speakers and all of our listeners as well. We've got about 1 minute left and still a number of questions. So I'm going to throw this last question to Tech Micro because it's so far the only software-based question I've seen, so I want to give the software people an opportunity. So unfortunately, this will have to be our last question. So, Andy, how would you integrate an FPGA-based system with a technology such as CORBA, which is used in SDR, software-defined radio systems?
Well, that's a good question. We actually had a customer who needed to do that, and what they did was they worked with us and with a company called PrismTech, which has an ORB set of software, sort of set of middleware. And what PrismTech did was they took our QuickStream software hardware layer and transported their CORBA protocol through it. So they were able to essentially CORBA enable an FPGA card without having a processor sitting next to it running the CORBA stack. The CORBA stack was all built into the FPGA itself and just talked natively over the network. So it was a pretty interesting thing.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. That brings us right up to our time limit today. I'd like to thank all of our presenters, their employers, and all of you who are following along remotely. You might be able to hear the cathedral bells in the background as I speak, so my apology. As I mentioned at the very beginning, we may not have had time to address all of your questions, and that is indeed the case. There are at least a dozen more here, so sorry that we didn't get to them. But as appropriate, someone may get back to you offline with answers to your individual questions. BusyCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 48 hours, and note that an audio-only podcast version will also be available. And yes, you can search for the words, quote, embedded_e-cast, that's embedded_e-cast on iTunes, and you'll find all of OSM's eCasts available for download as audio MP3s. Well, that brings us past our time limit today. Thank you all for attending. We're adjourned. Goodbye.